Welcome to the intersection of theater and even more theater. You have achieved stage grok. Stage Grok, the roaming theater podcast, coming to you from the geographic center of the American Theater. I'm your host, Scott Miller. Today, I'm talking with historian and Washington University professor Todd Decker about the landmark musical Showboat. I spoke to him in his office at Washington University. Hi, well, thank you so much for talking to me today. I want to talk about Showboat, obviously. You've written two books,
right?
About Showboat.
Yeah.
So I guess my first question is, what's the big deal? Why was it special in 1927, and is it still special?
I think it was special in 1927 because of the book, because Showboat was this huge bestseller by a big-selling author, Edna Ferber. There was great enthusiasm about trying to adapt this show. So, from my perspective, the majority of the people in the New York audience that went and saw Showboat in 1927 had probably read the book. So it was a...
I didn't realize that.
So it was a real... I mean, it was a huge seller. It came out in, August of 1926. And 3 months later, the publisher, Doubleday, was selling it as the best-selling book of 1926.
Wow.
And literally, a year later, it's on Broadway. The poster art... The poster art for the show was drawn from the fly leaves of the novel. So there was this, and there were moments where Hammerstein initially wanted to recreate, there was a plan to recreate the cover of the book on stage in sort of a tableau.
Right.
So I think for the initial audience, there was that attraction.
I didn't realize the book was that big a deal.
So it was a huge seller.
So I'm about two-thirds of the way through the book.
Yes.
And I love it.
She's so much
fun.
She is a totally readable author.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you like the story, she wrote about 8 other books that have exactly the same story. I mean, literally exactly the same story.
That's funny.
A woman marries badly, has a child, a single, an only child, the husband leaves, and then the woman soldiers on and succeeds.
Did Edna Ferber marry badly?
She never married. But that was her plot. And she arrived at that plot the book before Showboat, which is so big, which won the Pulitzer Prize. So she was a major literary figure. And she still owns a quarter of the rights to the show, her heirs. When you want to do anything with Showboat, you've got to negotiate with Ferber's descendants, lawyers, as well as the Hammerstein and Rogers folks.
Right.
Or Kern folks.
So my impression of Showboat is that it was sort of a musical comedy. Like, it had a lot of elements of musical comedy. It had the funny second couple and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But it really upended everything about musical comedy.
So you have the operetta couple, and Gaylord and Magnolia were an operetta. I mean, if you went and saw it in 1927, the man who played Gaylord was the man who had premiered the lead role in Student Prince of Heidelberg. He was the king of high seas on Broadway. I mean, this was a serious Broadway operetta singer.
And this was?
Howard Marsh.
Oh, right.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Sure. I don't have a show for you. But he was this major singer. So there was good, legit singing. And we often don't think about Broadway in the 20s as about operetta, but the longest running shows were almost all operettas. Student Prince, Maytime, Blossom Time. I mean, Blossom Time is the show from the 20s. I mean, this was an era that loved great singing. So you get that with Showboat, and they're in period costumes, right? Looks like an operetta. But you also had, like you said, musical comedy. Even at the end of the show with Kim, a kind of contemporary musical comedy. Originally, they wanted to put in a scene that was basically at someone like George Gershwin's apartment, where Gershwin, this sort of like Gershwin character sitting at the piano would play an old time river song in a jazzed up style for Kim. So you got a little bit of that. And then of course there's all the black show elements. The 20s is a great era for black musical comedies.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you get Rope, the Joe character, originally supposed to be Robeson, Paul Robeson, but this sort of a serious black dramatic element, which had just come into Broadway. So the show Porgy, which Porgy and Bess was adapted from, which is part of the chain to Porgy and Bess, that was playing on Broadway right around the time that show would open too. They were playing concurrently in fall of 1927. So there were elements of Porgy in it. And then on top of that, there were there's the Ziegfeld element of it too. The scale, the sheer spectacle of it.
Right.
The scale of it. Although it didn't have the fancy costume, the novelty costume
right,
element
right.
of it. It did have the whole World's Fair scene at the opening of Act Two was a Ziegfeld extravaganza.
Of course.
So, which is interesting, and that's what gets cut now.
Right.
Right? Because people look at it and go, this is impossible
right.
to produce from a Ziegfeld perspective.
Too expensive
this
and
is,
kind of pointless. And...
Yeah. Too expensive and pointless for us. But
yeah.
for those audiences, wow, that was, you know, a major investment. And every once in a while you run across a production of Showboat in later years where they decided to go whole hog and just invest in the World's Fair, even though it really serves no dramatic purpose.
My impression is that we had not had a musical that treated actual issues in that serious a way. Do you think that's true? I mean, there were serious musicals, but it seems to me like there weren't serious musicals that dealt with miscegenation and
sure.
domestic
yeah.
abuse.
Right, and those things come out of the novel.
Right.
So yeah.
And was that shocking, or was the show entertaining enough?
If it was shocking, the original reviewers didn't write about it. If it was shocking to them, it wasn't something that they really latched onto. But, and in fact, it really isn't until the 60s that reviewers and people that write on musical theater started to say, hey, this show deals with race issues. This is a serious show. I mean, it really isn't until the 1960s, in the middle of the civil rights movement, when white commentators on the musical and on Showboat, people writing about Showboat, started to notice that aspect of it and make a big deal.
Why do you think it wasn't a big deal at first?
The white press didn't talk about stuff like that. They just didn't deal with
do you
race.
Think the
black press did. The black press dealt with it. And,
but not always favorably, right?
Right. I mean, they were mixed because the black press was always mixed on these shows because on the one side they were selling stereotypes, but on the other side they were giving top black talent great exposure on Broadway in Midtown. You know, putting the best African American performers up there side by side with white performers, where at the end of the show you could listen to the applause and say, look. We're every bit as good. In fact, we're getting bigger applause. It's fascinating. Showboat went on tour in 1946. It was revived on Broadway in 1946. And then that went on tour. That production went on tour. And there was a... they changed the some of the dance roles and sort of amplified... They created a featured dance role for a black male performer. And... in a couple numbers, in Queenie's Ballyhoo and at the fair, and later he had another number too. And all the reviewers, all over the country, everybody said, oh, it's a great production of Showboat, but that black dancer, he was the best part of the show. Everyone responded to that one performer. I have a picture of him in my book. You know, he was just this incredibly charismatic figure, and they carved out a little space for him. He wowed the audience every night. So it's hard to be against, it's hard to really be against Showboat when it's providing, you know, big time exposure for black artists.
Well, and
there's always just that struggle that you read about it
right.
in looking at shows today.
Right.
Too.
I mean, even though there were black stereotypes there, but they were also real people too. I mean, Queenie and Joe were a real couple that had an obvious history.
Right.
Somewhat complex emotions and so forth.
Right. Yeah, and they get the best songs.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they get great songs. If the plot's about the white characters, really, the score is really conflicted over who gets... it's almost like your personal taste in music is going to be what determines who you think wins the score. Right? If you like operetta singing, and not a lot of people do anymore,
right.
If you like operetta singing, you're going to glom onto Gaylord, but he's not the natural... I saw they did a revival of Showboat recently at Chicago Lyric Opera, and you would think, okay, the Lyric Opera. Who got the biggest applause? Queenie and Joe.
Yeah.
Queenie got huge applause. She came out and did a number late in Act Two in that version, and it basically woke the place up. So it, you know, it's this, and I think black critics and folks within the black community who want to talk about, you know, visibility or stereotypes, there's always this show, it always sort of offers this evidence that in fact the most attractive figures on stage, when you put them up there side by side, it's the black performers in this show who really shine and become stars. But that's why they made the show. They made the show for Robeson. I mean,
right,
I think the whole goal of this show was to get Paul Robeson up on, was to find a vehicle for his extraordinary charisma and talent that at a time on Broadway when it was hard to come up with something. You know, there's people like that all the time. You
right.
look at that, and they're like these incredibly talented performers,
yeah.
and you're like, what show could this person
right.
be in? You know, I look at someone even like Lilias White.
Oh,
you know,
love her.
She's terrific.
Yeah.
This woman should have had a huge Broadway
yeah.
career, but finding a way to put her into the narrative form of the musical proved difficult. And of course, it's ironic that Robeson didn't say yes to it, right? That
yeah.
they hold out this thing to him. Here, Ziegfeld will feature you in this huge main stage production, and he's like, no.
So my own history with Showboat.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I saw it two or three times at the Muni. Always hated it. Always thought it was boring. And then sometime in the 80s, when I was ushering at the Muni, there was a production that just blew my mind. The pacing was amazing. None of the songs were super slow. The acting was really good. I mean, they really treated it with respect. They
right.
treated it like any other show.
Yeah.
It suddenly was not a museum piece anymore.
Well,
and I was like, oh my God, Showboat's a great show. Like, a great show.
Yeah.
And then later I saw the Hal Prince revival, which I loved. And I've always hated the MGM movie.
Right.
I just think it's awful beyond words.
Yes.
But then I discovered the 1936 movie, which I love.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the closest we're ever going to get to knowing what the original was like. Do you think that's true? Do you think we get some sense of it?
In the 36?
Yeah.
Sure. I think we get...
Because some Broadway cast, some London cast,
right?
Right.
Right. And I think we also get... certainly we get Robeson and in the 1936 film. And, you know, I teach a history of popular music class to undergrads, and at the end of the year, I'll ask, you know, so which singer, we look at lots of singers, you know, from the very beginning of recorded music to the present, and like, you know, who do you remember? What's the voice you remember? Robeson always gets mentioned. I mean, there's this immediate, there's just an immediate response to the power of his voice, right? So you get to see him in that part.
And that Old Man River sequence is incredible. I mean,
yeah.
it's just, it's powerful
right.
stuff.
And you know, all those cutaways to the laboring and
yeah.
all that, those are Hammerstein's idea. Almost everything in
and
that
he wrote
is
screenplay, right?
He wrote the screenplay.
Yeah.
But those are Hammerstein's idea. In fact, what Hammerstein wanted that got cut, if you watch those sequences, you see black laborers, but you don't see white overseers.
Oh.
And Hammerstein, in the script, wanted white overseers. I mean, he really
wow.
wanted not only just to show the blacks, black men working, but also to show white men over them,
right,
and that got cut,
and I think it was an extra song they wrote for the film "I Still Suits Me" or something
yeah,
like that,
yeah,
which is also delightful and such a cool character piece. Like
yeah.
you get such insight into that relationship, which
right.
I think is awesome.
Right. Well, and you have Queenie's played by Hattie McDaniel, who's you know a charismatic screen presence, and one I think that we respond to differently because we recognize her. Right, from Gone with the Wind.
Right.
I mean, there's that
right.
energy. But I think what I love about the 1936 is you also get Helen Morgan in the role of Julie.
Ugh.
And, I mean, that's a role that has really changed in who plays it. So in the 80s, around the time when you're mentioning, in the 80s, that role flipped from being a role for white women to being a role for black women. Or mixed race women.
Right.
Lonette McKee was the first to do it on Broadway in like 87. She does it again in 94. And now it's standard casting to cast an actress who identifies as black or multiracial. Whether she looks like she could pass or not, it's now a convention of Showboat in the theater to for Julie to be played by a woman who identifies in some way. And you get performers like Alison Cambridge, this opera singer who is sort of playing the part all over the place now in the last 10 years. She on her website, she identifies as a proud multiracial woman sort of thing. So, but before the 80s, that role was given to white women. And Helen Morgan, to very different kinds of white women voices too. And I think one of the things I love about that performance is that, you know, she was, Helen Morgan in 1927 on Broadway, was the big star of the production. It was
right.
Helen Morgan in Showboat.
Right.
She was the star. And she was a cabaret singer, a speakeasy singer. She was arrested the night after Showboat opened. She was arrested, a club where she sang Helen Morgan's, it's a club with her name in it. She was arrested when the club was raided. So, which great publicity, right? I mean,
that's
terrific
awesome.
Publicity.
How perfect for Julie.
Right. So, I mean, when audiences went and saw that 1927 Showboat, I think here's another reason why it was so successful. And Bernard Sobel, who was Ziegfeld's press agent, mentioned this. He said, you know, that show kept playing for as long as it did, because people would come up to the box office and say, is this the show where Helen Morgan sings about her bill?
Wow.
You know, which is not Julie, but Helen Morgan.
Right,
you know,
right.
We want to see her, the real thing. So that 36 film, I mean, Morgan dies a few years after that of alcoholism. And she's got a pretty sad, has a pretty sad story. She played Julie from 1927 until her death. That's basically what her career was built in many ways on Julie. There was this famous tour of the 1932 revival that fell on really hard times. And all the main Broadway stars in the revival that were touring the nation, they all start to drop away when their pay gets cut. And Morgan just like hangs on till the bitter end. She has nowhere else to go. Right. This is all she's got left is playing Julie.
So she is.
She
Julie.
Is. She is Julie. So it's always nice to. It's cool to get to see her.
Yeah.
And
she
is unlike
any other performer.
Right. And to wonder why did people
right
like, because you play the recordings of her singing those songs and you're like, why was this woman famous? Why was she the most remembered performance? I mean, you get reviewers for the 1946. Showboat on the first Broadway revival, which Hammerstein directed. I mean, it was supposed to be, Hammerstein directed it, and all the review, half of the New York reviewers, half of their reviews are basically, I miss Helen Morgan. Oh, gee, I miss Helen Morgan.
Wow.
I came to this show thinking, there's no way this could stand up to my memories of Helen. One reviewer, like a famous reviewer, like somebody whose name you'd recognize, I can't remember it off the top of my head, he wrote... His review was a letter to Helen Morgan apologizing for having enjoyed the revival.
Oh,
because,
my God.
Because this performance had meant so much to them. So I like her. I mean, Robeson in the 36th film, you're like, okay, I understand.
Yeah.
But Julie, Helen Morgan is Julie, you're like, I don't get it. What? And yet, you know, it's this mystery of historical style, this past... You know, why did people like that? I always wonder how people heard her, because she's
oh right,
so,
no
you know, how did anybody hear her? Although I've heard rumors. I can't remember. I wasn't able to document it, but I've heard rumors that she had there was like a mic hidden.
Oh,
you know, she sings from she sits on top of a piano.
Yeah,
and that's what she did in her act. She sat on, the reason Julie sits on top of the piano is because Helen Morgan, when she sang in nightclubs, sat on top of an upright piano.
Of course.
That's why that's in there.
So I think my favorite part of the movie, well, certainly the first time I saw it, the 36 movie, was hearing Can't Help Loving That Man at its correct tempo.
Yeah.
Because everybody takes it like it's this horrifically sad torch song, and it's not!
Yeah.
It's really joyful and playful.
Yeah.
And I think, in a way, that makes it even sadder when Julie's singing it. You know, that it's, for her, those things are pretty tragic. For the rest of us, it's pretty playful.
Right. Well, and it's also a blues, right? I mean, it's a blues number. The verse to it is actually a 12-bar blues. It doesn't have the same,
right.
It doesn't follow the AAB lyric, but Kearns, I've heard, who's it, Larry Starr, says this in his book on Gershwin, that you know, Candle of Love and That Man is Kern trying to write a Gershwin tune, trying to tap into blackness in some sort of really direct,
right.
uncharacteristic way. There's a great review of...
Well, and I have to say, when it's more up-tempo, it sounds more black. It sounds more ethnic to me.
Yeah, you feel it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and the blues is all about complaining about life or lamenting life, but doing it in a way that ends up bringing you joy. Right? It's about survival,
yeah.
and somehow this mix of sorrow and joy. It's the blues is not about, you know, feeling sad necessarily. It's about it's about doing something musically that you know puts away the sadness. There's this great review of I can't remember which production of it is, but where this reviewer talks about how on the repeat of Can't Help Loving That Man in the kitchen scene when the black chorus takes it up. He said that something like, and the whole, you know, at that moment, this whole production like lifts off the stage and the audience rises with this. There's just this like, this automatic energy this great energy that came out from that number in particular. And it comes right after Old Man River.
Right.
You got Old Man River and
well,
how's Make Believe ever going to compete with that? It's just not. Make Believe, no matter who sings it or how, it's just never going to compete with that energy.
What I love is when we get to that moment where the black chorus comes in and suddenly becomes this big number and all that, it's so musical comedy.
Right.
But it's got all this nasty subtext going on underneath about the serious stuff that this describes.
Right. No, but do you think about that when you're watching it?
Well,
or
I do, because
fact,
I grew
yeah.
up with everybody singing it like it was the
right.
saddest funeral dirge
and,
on the planet.
And that's because of MGM.
I know.
And it's also, interestingly, you know, who you can really lay it at the feet of is Lena Horne. Because Ava Gardner sings it in the MGM 1951,
right.
and Lena Horne in Till the Clouds
Roll
By.
Till the Clouds Roll By, right.
She sang it at that tempo. And, I mean, you put those two performances on top of each other, it's... they're identical. And even, if I remember right, Ava Gardner has said that she, for her audition for Julie, she lip-synced to Lena Horne's, recording.
Right.
Of it. So there's, it's all MGM. They just, like, let all the air out of the tires. And
they sanitized that story so profoundly.
Yeah. Right.
And I think just destroyed the score.
Well, and you wonder what, because Judy Garland was supposed to play Julie.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Which would have been amazing.
And she, if she had... they would have added another number for Julie to sing right after her racial status is revealed.
Oh.
She would have to go back on stage and sing one more song before leaving the showboat. And that was going to be Why Was I Born?
Oh,
which
wow.
is another great Hammerstein Kern
awesome.
Song that they wrote for Helen Morgan. Because right after Showboat, they wrote a vehicle for Helen Morgan called Sweet Adeline.
Right.
That is a good show, but that's a song from it. So you wonder how... Garland and her team at MGM, you know, the folks that would have been Roger Edens and Kay Thompson, the folks at MGM who sort of shaped her performances, you wonder if they would have put up with that, you know, because I don't think Ava Gardner could walk into an orchestra rehearsal and say, make it faster. But
right.
I just bet Garland probably could have.
Yeah.
Okay,
so...
or she could have sold the slow tempo.
Here's kind of, I think, the primary difficult thing about Showboat. Maybe it's not primary, but for me it is. And that's the language. And there are two things. One is the imposed dialect of
yeah.
Old Man River and Can't Help Loving That Man, etc. And the other is the N-word
right.
In the opening number. And I remember when they made the... John McGlynn made the kind of definitive Showboat recording, which I love. And I remember at the time there was a big controversy about whether or not
right.
they were going to put the N-word
yeah.
back in.
His
so,
black chorus
so what do you think
quit.
About all that stuff?
His so McGlynn's black chorus quit over it. They did not want to say the N-word.
It was a kind of big public controversy
yes,
at the time,
yeah, they
right?
made a, they made a big noise about it. In fact, he could only find... there's only two black singers on that whole record. Joe and Queenie are the only two. And
so he ended up not having a black
chorus. The black chorus, he originally hired the black chorus from Glyndebourne's production of Porgy and Bess. So here you have this, and this is so often the case with Showboat, that Showboat and Porgy and Bess kind of chase each other, because I think if you're a producer and you assemble the cast for Porgy and Bess, you're like, hey, I've got all these talented people. What other show could we do? There's one other show we could do. Showboat. So, and it's happened, you know, in the 21st century in American opera companies, there was a rash of Porgy and Besses, or a group of Porgy and Besses that came around the country, and it was followed shortly after by these productions of Showboat.
It would be interesting to see the two of them literally back to back.
Yeah.
And really compare them.
Right. I don't know that anyone's done them in the same season. That's interesting. But, so McGlynn lost his chorus. They walked out. And so the black chorus on that recording, this is the 1988 EMI recording, the black chorus is white.
Wow.
Is the white British Ambrosian chorus, who had been hired to sing the white chorus parts.
Right. So what do we do with all that now?
So I think there's ways to, there have been productions that give you the effect Hammerstein wanted, which was to shock you and to push the reality of American race relations onto a Broadway stage.
Now let me ask you, at the time, I assume a lot of people used the N-word regularly.
Yeah,
in the
20s. And it was on Broadway. Yeah.
That was what I was going to ask. Did they use it on stage?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's in Memphis. It's in the show Memphis, too. Although when I saw Memphis here, in St. Louis, it's in a line. Somebody says, you know, about rock and roll, that end music. And somebody in the audience gasped. Like, it was
wow.
Kind of cool, actually, in the
yeah.
sense that, you know, made you realize, yes, it's worth it to have this conversation
right.
about Showboat now.
Right.
I think Hammerstein wanted audience. I don't think it had been. I don't think it on Broadway. It was used in that in the serious way Hammerstein's using it. You know, he's putting it into the mouths of a chorus of black men in a scene where they are directly juxtaposing their labors to white folks at play. You know, I mean, it's a whole set of ideas about race relations and the economy.
Right.
And from a historical perspective, because it was even historical for him, right? And for his audience, it was still historical.
So beginning of Showboat, we're in the what?
1880s. Yeah.
Okay.
It depends. There's this really funny document when Ferber was writing the book, her editor sent her this thing that was like, so if Magnolia is this old, in the 1870s, and we end the book in 1920, that means Magnolia is now, I mean, and none of the ages really work. It was, and her editor had done this, put the ages of these characters. So I think if you want that effect, I don't think that having a chorus sing the N-word is going to get you the same effect now, right? It's not going to have that, it's not going to be acceptable.
What it just yanks us out of the show, right? We're just
right.
so hyper aware of that.
Right. And that word hasn't gone away from popular music, right?
Right?
It's still in rap. It's still it's still a part of the language of the nation, but it's in such a different way. It just can't operate in the same way.
Right.
It doesn't mean now coming out of the mouths of a group of black men in that situation in Showboat, it just can't mean the same thing.
Right.
So there's this production that was at the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey.
I think I have video of that. Wasn't that on PBS?
Yeah, it was on PBS.
Yeah, yeah.
And the director there, I can't remember his name. I talk about it a lot in the book. He came up with some really interesting solutions to... they sang colored folk work, which is what most people do now,
yeah.
and that's Hammerstein's preferred revision. I mean, I think that really works too, because... colored folk, we recognize today the term colored folk is a historical term, right?
Right.
It puts
right.
us into the past.
Right.
In the way that the N-word can't, right?
Right.
The N-word can't put us in the past in that way.
Yeah.
But it would have been completely anachronistic for if you were actually in the 1880s, you wouldn't have said, wouldn't have said colored folk.
Right.
But so in this production in New Jersey, they sing colored folk, but then there's this moment where the Sheriff Vallon does this crossover. It's not in the script. In the middle of the opening chorus, the first musical sequence, he does this crossover, and this stage full of black laborers who are singing to each other, really, I think more than to us, singing to each other, they respond and get real, and the dynamic level goes down. So they respond to the appearance of a white man on the stage, a white man of power.
I like that.
Who later is, you know, is going to be, he's an evil guy.
Right.
He's the bad guy in the show. And so
that's really interesting.
Right. The director, he didn't change the chorus because Hal Prince basically cut it.
Right.
It's not there in the same way. He keeps Hammerstein's musical structure and Kern's musical structure, but instead changes the dynamics and the way the performers perform. So initially the black chorus, is singing this opening in a way that suggests they're complaining or they're speaking of their situation to each other, not to us, but to each other. And then the second they're no longer in a community setting, but this white man of power walks in, they change into something else. They put on this mask. They put on a defensive posture, the men and the women. And it's really effective. At least it works. It works in the television version. I wonder if you got it in the theater in the same way. Because you have to, you know, see, because in the TV production, they're able to say, oh, look, here comes the sheriff.
Right.
In, on stage, how easy is it to...
It seems like maybe that sort of gets at the same thing that Hammerstein was trying to get at with the overseers in Old Man River.
Right.
That the balance of power.
Right. And to put that on stage, and that, okay, that's unprecedented. If you want to talk about something that you would have seen in Showboat, socioeconomic, you know, like punch to the gut sort of thing, you know, here, confront this problem or confront this situation. That's new. And that's, for my reading of it, that's all Hammerstein's doing. That is, you know,
right.
Hammerstein's burden, because he keeps trying to bring it back and somehow return that theme. But he's not going to write a whole show about it.
Right.
He's just not going to write a whole show about it.
What do we do with the written dialect? Do we ignore it now? What do we do? I don't think it ever affects rhymes that I can think of.
Oh, it does. Even in Can't Help Loving That Man.
Yeah.
Because when Helen Morgan sings Can't Help Loving That Man, she doesn't sing it in dialect, and it spoils the rhymes. And that's one of the signs. That's one of her ways as Julie of saying, oh, I'm really white.
Right,
because,
right.
You know, I'm not... I might know this song,
because
but I don't really know how to sing it.
She learned it in dialect, right?
Right.
As a kid.
And one of the ways that she's passing now is to no
is
longer
to let go of the
she's
dialect.
Put aside her dialect. So, no, it's you're stuck with it. I think the only... you can do it... obviously, you can do it for comic effect, or you can do it in a way that suggests...
Kind of self-awareness.
Right. Or you can do it in a way that suggests... you can do it to get a cheap laugh, right? Or you can do it to... you can speak and sing in black dialect in a way that suggests dignity. And that comes straight out of Robeson, right? Robeson didn't fix.
Right.
He sang lots of black spirituals and black folk songs, and he didn't fix the dialect. He sang it with a sort of supersized dignity, right? And
is what strikes me most about seeing him, is that unbelievable, like, inner dignity.
Right. And audiences in the 20s saw it. White audiences
in
the 20s saw
that. Which I think makes Joe for me.
Right. And that's, well, he's Joe. If Julie is Helen Morgan sitting on the piano drunk, then Joe is Robeson, this sort of mysterious figure of undeniable power, who was actually also a sex symbol in the 20s. And 30s.
Oh, wow.
And there's
this
amazing story by Dorothy Parker right around the time Showboat came out, called Arrangement in Black and White, about this society woman, New York society woman, who goes to a party, and Robeson's there, a Robeson-like figure is there. And the climax of this story is she talks to him and she shakes his hand. And you know, this is, to touch him is... both titillating and also sort of this, because I think the story ends with her saying, what will my husband say when he hears I've touched the hand of a black man? Right. So there's, he's a real complex figure. But I think you can do the dialect with dignity. And Gretha Boston, who played Queenie in the Prince revival, she played Queenie that way and articulated it that way. She as much as said in the run-up to the show, I have never seen Showboat. I don't ever want to see Showboat. I'm not going to play the part that way. I don't look upon this as a mammy role.
Right.
I look upon this as a strong black woman, a woman of character, a woman who is the backbone of her community.
And she's right. That is
and
Queenie.
And that's who she is. But it's just as easy to play Queenie,
yeah.
you know.
As Mammy.
As Mammy. And Hammerstein recognized that difference. There's this great, great letter from 1948 in a black newspaper. Actually, it's in the Daily Worker, the communist newspaper of the United States, where this black colonist, sort of called Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hammerstein, out for this revival of Showboat and said, it's selling stereotypes. And Hammerstein said he defended it strongly. He really defended the show. And it's interesting because he said, you know, if there are moments of racial stereotype, like, for instance, when Queenie gets a big laugh because of the way she performs the part, he basically says, you can't blame the writers for that. That's the performer's choice. In other words, she chose to play the part that way. And he even suggests sort of, you know, the director, him, might have tried to get her not to do that.
No.
But she's doing, you know, she's getting a cheap stereotypical laugh.
And it's hard to get an actor to give up a laugh.
Well, yeah, yeah. But that's what's so interesting about Greta Boston then in 1994, because she plays the role completely seriously.
Yeah.
She doesn't get any laughs, but she got a Tony Award. You know, I mean, she gets, you know, gets a kind of she proved you can play the part as a dramatic role instead
right.
of a comic
right.
role.
Right, right.
And that's the other thing about show. That's pretty amazing. Can you think of another show that has a part that can flip from a comic role to a dramatic role and in both ways be satisfying
right.
to someone?
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah, it is.
All right, so you've written this second book called Who Should Sing Old Man River?
Yes.
What is your central argument here?
It's actually a lost chapter from the Showboat book.
Oh, nice.
That grew too large.
Okay, well, I have to say, I love the first Showboat book you wrote.
Thanks.
I just think it's incredibly, like, I really do love Showboat, but I just thought it was incredibly interesting, and, you know, as the guy who reads every musical theater book ever written, there was so much about Showboat I didn't know that I know now, which is really cool. So talk about this second book.
So this, originally I was going to have a chapter on pop music versions of Old Man River, and when my list of these versions ended up, you know, when I had like 250 of them, I realized there's no way to do this
I didn't realize
in a
that
chapter.
Many people recorded that
oh,
song.
Yeah, yeah.
That's crazy.
And so I just follow the song through history and look at what performers did to it.
Now, is it mostly white performers?
No.
Oh,
it's white and black.
Okay.
Singing groups, you know, groups,
oh, right,
performers.
Right, right.
Soloists, instrumental versions. I have a section on like orchestral easy listening versions for your home hi-fi. You want to listen to Old Man River during dinner? Here's an orchestral version. Jazz band versions. It was a jazz rhythm tune for years and years and years.
Kind of bothers me that they're like, I guess what I would consider trivial versions of this amazing song.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and there is sort of a moment of when is a performance? So it becomes it's a really interesting song in the sense that performers have a wide latitude of choice. They can do it as a ballad, or they can do it as a rhythm tune. You can do it as a sort of display of your vocal technique, or you can just use it as a scaffolding for jazz improvisation. Right. There's a whole tradition of Old Man River in jazz as a vehicle for drum solos. Figure that out.
That's bizarre.
Yeah, right. And I think it becomes the matter that somebody does a successful version of it, and
right.
then so other people do versions of that version.
Right.
And I don't think that I think good, obviously, some good jazz players think it's important to interpret the lyrics of a tune,
oh, right.
but others don't, right? Others right. say, you know, these chords, this tune,
right.
they are sitting there waiting for me to do something to them. I will now do what I want without feeling like I'm commenting on the
right.
on the content of the song.
Right.
But so it just grew out of this list of recordings. And the cool thing with Spotify and online now is, you know, everyone has access to all these. There's very few in the book that aren't available electronically, you know, sort of instantly at your fingertips. So it's sort of a listening companion
to this
song. And it also tries to, because there is this moment when Ullman, sort of the number of versions, of recorded versions, and the variety of recorded versions peaks in the late 50s and 60s. That's when there were the most.
Do I remember right that Sinatra did it?
Oh, Sinatra did it. Sinatra does it until the 80s. He's one of the last white men left doing it, but I think he's sort of grandfathered in, right? I mean, he's able to do things in the 80s that young... I mean, I don't think that Michael Bublé is going to do a cover of Sinatra's Old Man River.
And to some extent, I mean, I kind of like Sinatra doing it because he did have that low resonant voice, and it does still sort of keep the character of the song. You know, it doesn't make it much higher or whatever, at least, I don't know.
I have a whole chapter on Sinatra that's not terribly appreciative of Sinatra. and sort of why I try to look into, you know, why he wanted to sing it in the first place. He started singing it.
I always assumed it was because he had a nice low voice.
Well, he starts singing it quite early, already in 1943. He's singing it. And I think he's singing it. He starts singing it in the midst of his fame as a, with the Bobby Soxers, in the midst of his early fame with young female audiences. And in many ways, I think it was an argument to, not to his fans, but to everybody else. I'm a serious singer. I'm a real singer. I'm a man. I have a low voice,
right?
I don't just sing in this high voice. I'm bigger than that. I'm better than that. I'm more manly than that. Well, and there's this whole discourse around the song of manliness, of matching Robeson's manliness. So Old Man River peaks in variety and number of recordings in the 60s. And you even start to get a few rock groups doing it. It's on, I'm blanking on the guy's name. It's on a rather unexpected rock album. Oh. Jeff Beck, Rod Stewart recorded Old Man River on Jeff Beck's album Truth, 1968.
That is truly bizarre.
Right. So it just barely gets to the edge of sort of a hard, you know, a genuine rock song. And right around 1969, it drops off the face of the earth, and nobody does it anymore. It just disappears.
Is that something about race in America?
I think it's by the end of the 60s, the place of the figure of a strong black man in American culture was shifting away from someone like Robeson, who is, you know, sort of an embodiment of the black man as long-suffering,
quiet,
powerful
dignity,
but you know, Joe is probably not going to join a protest march,
right? Right.
And Joe is certainly not going to join the Black Panthers,
right?
Right. The Black Panthers, by the way, had a version of Old Man River too, called Old Pig Nixon. That they did. Yes. So right around this time. So and I even found this advertisement in a magazine for advertisers. About how this is like 1970, you know, the black men of today, they don't want any more of that Old Man River stuff. They want, you know, something else. So there is, I think the song allows you to sort of identify this moment. Here is the moment when the figure of that kind of black man that Joe embodied with such strength and such resilience for decades goes permanently out of date. And from the 70s on, Joe himself is a historical figure. This isn't what powerful black masculinity looks or sounds or sings like anymore. So we enjoy Old Man River. Well, you either enjoy it as a historical tribute to that kind of black dignity, or in a more troubling analysis, you enjoy it as well. You know, that's the kind of blackness we will applaud. That kind of quiet dignity, not a blackness that stands up and demands change,
right.
But a blackness that stands there and says, "Yes, I have dignity, but I'm not going to
cause trouble.
Push for change, cause trouble. And, you know, the reaction to Old Man River, wherever it's sung, is sort of creepy, in the sense that you go and see Showboat now, and I told my, we went and saw at the Muni a couple years ago, and I took my kids, and I said, you know, there's going to be this guy is going to step to the front of the stage, and he's going to sing this song, and then the audience is going to go crazy. They're going to go crazy. And they're going to, and some people are going to stand up,
right.
And the you're going to look at the audience and go, what are these people applauding for? And I still really wonder, what are they applauding for? Are we applauding for a song that we all love? Are we applauding this historical moment?
Right.
Or are we sort of, or in the mostly white audiences for musical theater, are we applauding, there's a black man we can applaud. And that's Showboat.
Creepy.
Right, then Showboat becomes this disturbing text. But hey, I went and saw it at, like I said, at Chicago. Old Man River brings down the house.
Yeah.
And every time he sings it like four times. Every time he sings it, so it's an interesting song in that respect.
Okay, so last question.
Yeah.
Does Showboat still have relevance for us? We're still having race trouble.
Yeah. I think, yeah.
I mean, it feels to me like it does.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that it's...
We still have domestic abuse. We still have race issues, et cetera, et cetera.
I think one of the real challenges with making it interesting for a contemporary musical theater audience is that it, so much of blackness on Broadway since rock and roll has been, you know, put, I think it, maybe it's this, better put this way, that Showboat can never sort of tap into gospel, and so much so much of the energy of blackness on Broadway stages is comes from gospel, like from a show like Pearly or The Wiz,
Color Purple,
right? You know, the list goes on and on. There's this black gospel version of Brotherhood of Man and How to Succeed from the '90s with Lilias White.
Yeah,
you know, there's this sense on Broadway. I think that it's one way that Broadway has tapped into sort of a black popular music energy has been to draw on gospel or rock and roll, or now, you know, hip hop in some ways with Hamilton. And the real challenge, I think, is that Showboat's never really going to let you do that.
Right.
You can't have a gospel number. You have a spiritual, but you don't have that that kind of energy. And you do have to sit through the story of Magnolia and Ravenol and somehow make it. I mean,
and that part is really old-fashioned.
It is. It's really old-fashioned.
And
I her reading the letter, you know.
That. I can deal with that.
Yeah, you
but
love
it
musical
is really,
theater. Right. You,
right.
Yeah.
Right. And I grew up with the old-fashioned stuff.
Right, right. And the other hard thing, I think, is just it's so big. You know, I think if you're a community theater company that wants to do a show that deals with real issues and that audiences will love and that will have a big audience that can bring in a diverse audience... these days, I bet you would choose Ragtime,
right,
instead of Showboat, because Ragtime has a gospel number at the end of Act One. There's even a gospel. There's like gospel in the score. It says, you know, gospel improvisation here.
Well, and Ragtime deals with a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah, a lot,
but in a much more modern way.
Right, in a way that we sort of we know how to vibrate with
right.
it. Where with Showboat, we're constantly having to think historically.
But,
so,
you know, I'm constantly telling people to watch the 1936 movie because I do feel like it's really entertaining and it's really not what people are used to with Showboat. They're used to this kind of stodgy, you know,
but that's
slow moving.
That's still the legacy of all the operetta,
right.
All the operetta productions of it in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I think it is interesting that if it's going to survive anywhere, I don't think it'll ever go back on Broadway again. And even that, the 94 production that ran for 2 years... this is a Garth Drabinsky production, and, you know, it was a completely unsustainable thing.
Right.
It never made any
production.
Money. It was massive, and, I mean, it was the product...
And they did a lot of rewrites, right?
Right, right,
yeah.
But it was the product of, it wasn't the market bringing
right,
Showboat.
Right, right,
it was Drabinsky
right.
bringing Showboat to
right,
Broadway,
right.
And this man, like, you know,
yeah.
ended up being indicted.
Yeah.
Basically, for, you know, this is not a model for how Showboat might return. I think it's moved into the Opera House, and it's there. Opera Kentucky is doing it this year. You know, it's moving from in the last 5 years, Chicago, Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Houston,
oh, wow.
Now Kentucky have all done it.
Nice.
So, I mean, I think that's a place that'll survive. But they're used to...
So you know,
opera houses
still
are
us.
All about big... I mean, it'll be there, but it'll be an opera house instead,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you for talking to me.
Sure.
It was
thanks.
Fun.
Yes.
Thank you for joining us. This is Scott Miller. Now you, too, have achieved stage grok. See you next time.